shiver, and the shivering made her smile. By 10 o'clock, she was showered and lying naked on a double chaise longue on the deck at the beach house, protected from view by the half wall and the darkly tinted glass windbreak above. The sun felt extraordinary on her skin. She sensed the tension draining out of her, and without even meaning to, she fell asleep. She was wakened by a rustling and opened her eyes to see Dante, also naked, sitting on the chaise next to hers. He had her handbag at his feet and her passport in his hand. "What are you doing?" she asked. "Memorizing the number on your passport. I can do that when I put my mind to it. It's like taking a picture." "Where'd you get my passport?" "It was in your bag. Why keep it with you? Are you going someplace?" "I picked it up at the bank the other day and forgot to leave it at the house." "Why are you going through my handbag?" "It seemed rude to ask how old you are, so I thought I'd see for myself." She smiled. "My age is no secret." "Now it's not. March 15th. The Ides," he said. "Here's something you probably don't know. The Ides refers to the 15th of March, May, July, and October. Refers to the 13th of all other months. My birthday is November 13th. So that's the Ides. Just like yours."
"Meaning what?"
"Nothing. I just think it's interesting," he said. He returned the passport and moved forward until he was kneeling on the deck. He placed his mouth on her breast. She made an involuntary sound, low in her throat, as the heat opened her at the core. The two of them moved into their lovemaking with an ease that suggested they'd been together for years. There was an intensity she couldn't remember ever experiencing, and she gave up all sense of herself, responding with a tenderness that matched his. Afterward, they showered together and then wrapped themselves in terry cloth bath sheets and returned to the deck. Dante had brought a bottle of champagne and two crystal flutes, and they toasted their own joy. It felt wicked to sip champagne at this hour of the day. "Almost forgot," Dante said. He got up and went into the bedroom, returning moments later with a handful of travel brochures he dropped into her lap.
"What are these?"
"The Maldives. That's where I'm going when the time comes. Maybe the Philippines. I haven't decided yet. I brought brochures for both because I thought you might like to see them." He sat down on the edge of the chaise and loosened his towel. She opened the first brochure, which showed photographs of the Maldives, teal and aquamarine waters, with islands like stepping stones spread out across the sea. She sent him a curious look, wondering how serious he was. "I thought you were under indictment. They're not going to let you go out of the country." "Just because they won't let me doesn't mean I won't go."
"Aren't they holding your passport?"
"I've got another."
"What if they intercept you at the airport?"
"They can't intercept me if they don't know. I've got a fortune in offshore bank accounts. I've been planning this for years." She held up the brochures.
"Why the Maldives? I don't even know where they are."
"The Indian Ocean, 250 miles southwest of India. Temperatures run between 70 and 91 year-round. They don't have extradition treaties with the U.S. There are other choices. Ethiopia or Iran, if you'd prefer. You like Botswana? I'll throw it in for laughs."
"What in the world would you do with yourself?"
"I don't know. Rest, read, eat, drink, make love to you, study the language."
"Which is what?"
"Don't know yet. I'll find out when I get there. I'll have Luell call you with the details, but only if you're coming with me. Otherwise, the less you know, the better."
"You think I'd go?"
"Why not? There's nothing keeping you here. All you need with you is an overnight case. I'll take care of the rest."
"Let's talk about something else."
"No problem. I understand you need time to consider. I'm laying it out so you know what we're dealing with."
"You know I'm not going."
"I don't know that, and neither do you."
She sat up, pulling the towel around her. Don't turn this into something it's not.
What is it not?
It's not deep or complex or even very significant. It's a way to spend the morning when I'm not getting my hair done.
So I'm just a trivial screw?
I never said you were trivial.
But I'm just some guy you're screwing. It doesn't mean anything more to you.
That's correct.
You're lying.
Yes, I'm lying. Let's just leave it at that.
She nodded the towel in front and got up. He grabbed her hand.
Don't go. Don't walk away from me. Sit. There's no point in talking about the future when we don't have one.
Listen to me. Would you just listen? Don't hide from me. Don't hold back. Maybe you're right. Maybe this is just a fling. But that's not what it feels like to me. If this is all we have, then let's be honest with each other. Can't we do that?
She looked down at him. His was the face she loved. But she couldn't tell him that.
He tugged at her hand, and she sat down beside him. He lifted her hand and put her fingers against his lips.
Nora, whatever happens, whether you go with me or not, you've got to get out of that marriage.
Maybe that's what I am to you. A midwife, delivering you from him.
We've been through a lot together. You don't throw away a life because it's rough now and then. History counts for something.
No, it doesn't. You think being in a bad relationship for a long time makes it worthwhile? It doesn't. It's more time wasted. 14 years of misery is 14 too many.
Channing and I have had good years. I don't cut and run.
What about your ex? You don't think divorce is a form of running away?
We didn't divorce. He died.
Of what?
A fluke. A heart anomaly he'd had since birth. Something the doctors missed. He was a banker. He had a great job. He was 36 years old with no idea whatsoever he was living on borrowed time. I thought life was perfect. We had each other. We had our boy. We also had a hefty mortgage and a lot of credit card debt. What we didn't have was life insurance. So when he dropped dead, I was left without a dime. I was 34 years old, and I'd never held a job. I was in a panic, desperate for someone to take care of me. I met Channing 6 months later, and by the time Tripp had been gone a year, I was married to him. My son was 11. Channing's twin girls were 13.
Dante squinted at her. What did you say?
About what?
Did you say Tripp?
Yes.
You were married to Tripp Lanahan?
I've mentioned him before.
You never said his name. I had no idea.
Well, now you know, she said. She glanced at him. The color had drained from his face, and he was staring at her. What's wrong?
Nothing.
You're white as a sheet.
He shook his head briefly as though to ward off a ringing in his ears. We did business once. He approved the loan when I was buying my house. No other banker in town would touch me because of what I did for a living.
She smiled. He was a good judge of human nature, and he wasn't afraid to bend the rules.
Dante hung his head. He'd said the same thing about Tripp in referring to him. He ran a hand down his face, pulling his features out of alignment. She put her arm around him and gave him a squeeze.
I have to go. I told Channing I had a meeting with my broker in Santa Monica. Sounded like a lie when I said it, but it turns out to be the case. Are you okay? You look like you've seen a ghost.
I'm fine. He put his hand over hers without quite meeting her eyes.
She tilted her head and leaned against him. Will I see you tomorrow?
I'll call to let you know. You drive safely.
I will.
The meeting with her broker was brief. He was in his early 70s, lean and humorless. He'd managed her portfolio for 20 years, so long he thought of it as his own. When she told him she was cashing in her stocks, he seemed confused.
Which ones?
All of them. May I ask why?
I don't like what the market's doing. I want out.
He was silent for a moment, and she could see him struggle to frame his response.
I can appreciate your concern, but this isn't the time to bail out. I'd have to advise against anything so precipitant. It's not smart.
Fine. You've advised me. You can transfer the money to my Wells Fargo account in Santa Teresa. Minus your commission, of course.
Perhaps you're having problems, he said, too proper to ask outright.
Perhaps, but not of the sort you imagine.
Because, you know, you can talk to me if there's anything amiss. I'm in your camp.
I appreciate your loyalty.
Is this coming from Channing?
Please, Mark, just do what I've asked. Put in the cell orders and let me know when everything's cleared.
In the car, driving north along Pacific Coast Highway from Santa Monica, she lowered the window and let her hair blow around her face. She hadn't realized her intention until she spoke of it aloud. She liked the idea of having all that cash on hand, should the need arise. She wasn't thinking about what might happen in the coming weeks. She wasn't thinking of packing or of meeting Dante at the airport or of getting on a plane. All those actions lay beyond the realm of propriety, personal dignity, and common sense. But what if, at the last minute, she should change her mind? What if what seemed so impossible right now became imperative to her sense of herself? She needed to be prepared, should the need arise. That's how she thought of it. Should the need arise. That notion was the motivation for her stopping by the bank to empty her safe deposit box before she'd left for Santa Monica that morning. It was the reason she'd kept her passport with her this past week, relieved the expiration date was still 6 years hence. Should the need arise. Had her counting the cash she had on hand, tucking her good jewelry in her handbag. If she didn't go anywhere, which she probably wouldn't, then what had she really lost? The cash would go back in the bank, and she'd use the money she'd netted from the sale of her stocks to buy into the market again. Turning right off of PCH, she began the long, twisted ascent to the house. Set against a wide, pale blue sky, she could see four enormous birds circling, wings outstretched, silver flight feathers visible as they rode the thermal currents. If there were ever an act she envied, it would be the graceful gliding of such birds, soaring without effort, sailing on the wind, the land spread out beneath them as they lifted and wheeled. It would be quiet up there, peaceful, and the ocean would go on for miles. She kept an eye on them, wondering what had drawn them to the mountain. As the road wound upward, she realized they were larger than she'd first thought. Turkey vultures, by the look of them, with 6-foot wingspans. She'd seen them up close on occasion, tearing at carcasses on the road, their featherless heads and necks red and scaly looking. They had a reputation for being gentle and efficient, nature's humble servants cleaning up carrion. Being bald, they could plunge their heads deep inside a carcass to get at the rich inner meat. She turned into the driveway and left her car on the parking pad. She'd expected to see Mr. Ishiguro's pickup truck with its cargo of rakes and brooms. The house cleaning crew had come and gone. She saw the bulging bags of trash they'd discarded in their wake. The vultures were directly overhead, like fast-moving clouds that blotted the sunlight. One vulture had settled on top of a garbage can, and he fixed her with a look, his posture hunched and cunning. The vulture hissed at her and launched itself laboriously with a noisy flap of its wings. She opened the lid of the garbage can and recoiled from the stench and the swarm of flies. Mr. Ishiguro had discarded a rotting chicken carcass. Nora banged down the lid, hand against her mouth as though to shield herself from the repulsive clot of flesh. Channing said he'd bait the leg hole traps with chicken carcasses, but how many had he set? Taped to the glass in the back door, she found an envelope that contained the receipts for 3 traps Mr. Ishiguro had purchased. The chicken carcasses he must have acquired without charge. She unlocked the back door and tossed her handbag and the envelope on the counter. She flipped off her sandals and found a pair of running shoes she pulled on without socks. She grabbed two pieces of firewood and went out the back door again. She pushed through the gate in the retaining wall and set off along the fire path, her gaze raking the landscape for signs of a trap. She found the first in a tangle of brush that Mr. Ishiguro had apparently used to disguise the heavy iron jaws of the device. The carcass was still there, and she used one piece of firewood to trip the mechanism. The jaw snapped shut and broke the 4-inch thick branch in half, sending the pieces flying past her face. Nora jumped, shrieking, and then set off again, nimbly avoiding the paddle cactus that threatened her on all sides. She found nothing more on that narrow dirt lane, and when she reached an intersecting path, she eased down along the incline, hoping she wouldn't fall. Two big vultures had settled on the ground like sentinels, guarding their find. The male coyote had been caught in a second trap. Aside from the birds, she might not have noticed him except for the female trotting nervously back and forth across the path below her. Mr. Ishiguro had concealed the trap in a soft mound of dry grass. The coyote lay on his side, panting. There was no way of knowing how long he'd been there. His left hind leg was broken, the jagged bone end protruding. The ground around him was dark with blood. She stood stock still, not wanting to frighten the animal into a renewed attempt to escape. He rested. After a minute, he lifted his head again and twisted sideways to lick the wound. His suffering had to be acute, but he made no sound. His dull gaze settled on her with indifference. What was she to him when he was battling for his life? The hillside was hot, the air dusty with the little eddies of wind that picked up now and then. Nora turned on her heel and went back to the house. She was fearful and weeping, desperate to do something to end the animal's suffering. She went upstairs. She opened the bed table on Channing's side and took out his gun. He'd showed her how to load and fire the high-standard pistol with its push-button barrel takedown. The rear sight was stationary and micro-adjustable for elevation and wind. He'd been reluctant to buy the gun, but he'd done so at her insistence. She was there in the house alone on too many occasions to be left without a way to defend herself. She checked to see that it was loaded. The gun weighed 52 ounces, and she had to hold it with both hands as she went downstairs and out the back door. The female coyote had circled within range of her mate. She sat some distance away, in his line of sight, whining to herself. The male was diminished by pain. He lunged and thrust with his lean body, scrabbling for purchase against the weight of the trap. He looked at Nora. She could almost swear the coyote knew what she was about to do. In the depths of his yellow eyes, a spark of recognition flashed between them, her acknowledgement of his suffering and his acceptance of the bond. She had the power to free him, and there was only one way out. He was too wild a creature to allow her to get close enough to release him, even if she had a way to do so. The vultures flapped upward and circled above, eyeing her with interest. She wept. She couldn't bear to look at him, but she refused to look away. That this amazing beast had fallen, that he'd been subjected to such cruelty, was unthinkable. But there he lay, exhausted, his breathing shallow. To delay his death meant extending his agony. If she had no way to spare him, then she couldn't spare herself. She fired. One bullet and he was gone. The female watched incuriously as Nora sank to the ground close to the male. His mate turned and trotted down the trail and out of sight. She'd return to her pups. She'd go out hunting alone. She'd teach them to hunt as well, venturing into civilized territory if that was the only way to find food. She'd show them the sources of water. If rabbits and squirrels and moles were scarce, she'd show them where to find insects, how to run down, topple, and disembowel house cats inadvertently left outside at night. She'd do the job that was left to her in the only way she knew, driven by instinct. Nora returned to the house, holding the gun at her side. There was a black sedan parked next to her Thunderbird, and as she approached, two gentlemen in suits emerged and greeted her politely. There was nothing threatening about them, but she disliked them on sight. Both were clean-cut, one in his 50s, the other mid-30s. The younger man said, "Mrs. Vogelsang?" He handed her a business card. "I'm Special Agent Driscoll, and this is my partner, Special Agent Montaldo. We're FBI. I wonder if we might talk to you."
"About what?"
"Lorenzo Dante." She blinked at the two of them, making up her mind, and then went into the house without a word. The two men followed her in.
Chapter 27. I waited until mid-afternoon to drive past the pawn shop. This time, there was no sign of Len's car. I went around the corner and parked in the pay lot where I left my grabber blue Mustang between two pickup trucks. June spotted me as soon as I walked in, and her expression went blank. I said, "Hi, June. How are you?"
"Fine.
Something's come up, and I'm looking for Pinky. I thought you might know where he went."
"No clue."
"That's too bad. I talked to Dodie, and she told me he was here."
"I don't know where she got that idea."
"Come on, June. You're lying, and I know you're lying, which is almost as good as telling the truth. I don't know the details about Pinky's so-called plan, but the scheme is probably too harebrained to be worth his life." June stared at me with a helpless expression of someone watching a movie where she knows the ending isn't good. Len must have had done a number on her like the one he'd done on me. She was tense, and I wasn't sure how I was going to get through to her. I tried again. "Look, I know Sergeant Pretty was in here yesterday because I saw his car parked out front. Trust me, whatever he's telling you is bullshit. You know the man's a turd." She licked her lips and then dried the corners with two fingers. "He says there's a bench warrant out. Pinky's wanted for questioning, and if I don't turn him in, I'll be charged with aiding and abetting."
"There's no bench warrant," I scoffed.
"What are you talking about? He's got it in for Pinky because he stole a set of photographs."
"Don't ask who he stole them from because I don't know that part. Len Pretty wants them back and came close to choking me to death because he thought I was holding out on him.
He's probably threatened you with worse." Her voice was low. "He came to my house this morning before I left for work. He pushed his way in and tore the place apart."
"Looking for the photographs?"
"Probably," she said. "I told him I'd call the cops if he didn't get the hell out. He left, and I thought that might be the end of it. But then he stopped again here, demanding to search the shop. I'd already talked to my boss, and he said not without a warrant. So now Sergeant Pretty's gone off to get one. Door opened just now. I thought it was him."
"A warrant? Based on what?"
"He's yanking your chain. It's a fishing expedition, pure and simple. How is he going to find a judge who will sign off on that? He has to show probable cause."
"He said he was almost sure he'd get an anonymous phone tip."
"He's bullshitting."
"Maybe so, but what if he's not?"
"I take it Pinky's here."
She didn't nod, but she dropped her eyes, conceding the point.
"I was thinking once it got dark, I'd put him in the trunk of my car and take him someplace else. What do you suggest?"
I shook my head.
"Bad idea. Len's probably planted someone to keep an eye on you, so it's better if you stay put."
"What about you? He says it's just for tonight."
Len'll be watching me the way he's watching you. He knows darn well Pinky's on the premises, so he'll anticipate any attempt to get him out of here and into a car. Doesn't matter whose. They'll make a traffic stop using some excuse, and that'll be the end of it."
"We have to do something."
"I'm taking off. The longer I stay, the more it's going to look like we're hatching a scheme."
"You're leaving me?"
"Briefly. I have an idea, and if it works, you'll see me sooner than you think. Just don't make a move until I get back.
Okay.
Once I was out of the shop, I proceeded to the corner at a leisurely pace. I was operating on the assumption that anyone watching would note my departure and then be forced to choose whether to follow me or stick with June. I turned right onto the side street, but instead of returning to my car, I continued walking until I reached Chapel. If Len had assigned a vehicle surveillance, the focus would probably be on the Grabber blue Mustang. As long as that stayed where it was, I thought I might move with some degree of freedom. I crossed Chapel and went up to the next intersection, which put me in the same block as the consignment store. I went in. The woman at the counter looked up and greeted me warmly, a practice meant to discourage shoplifters who prefer to go unnoticed. I circled the store, browsing through racks of garments with a particular eye to coats. The temperatures in Santa Teresa sink into the 40s and 50s at night, and while heavy outerwear is uncommon, there's always a demand for something lightweight. I checked a couple of price tags and felt myself blanch. This was second-hand clothing, which I assumed was synonymous with cheap. Not so here. I tried to picture my last credit card statement, wondering if I had the wherewithal to charge the $500 or $600 the shop was asking. I'm a stickler for paying off my monthly balance, if I charge at all, but I couldn't remember what my limit was. It had to be close to $10,000. I stopped and thought about the situation. I had good reason to believe the shop was tied to an organized retail theft ring, which meant the woman who ran the place was a scofflaw. So why was I searching my conscience when she was a cheater? She appeared to my right.
Can I help you with something in particular?
I'm looking for a winter coat. Is this all you have?
Let me check in the back. I have a few items that came in I haven't had a chance to ring into the system.
She disappeared into the rear of the store and returned moments later with two coats on hangers. One was a double-breasted camel hair coat for $395 plus change. The other, a full-length black shearling for a nifty $500.
That one, I said, pointing to the camel hair. Very nice. Let's see how it fits.
She helped me slip my arms into the sleeves, and then she adjusted the coat at the shoulder until it sat properly. She directed me to the wall-mounted mirror nearby, and I modeled the coat, taking a look at myself from the rear. It actually looked pretty good.
Kind of pricey, isn't it? This is from Lord & Taylor. It retailed originally for $1,500.
Oh, well, I guess I better snap it up, I said. I waited while she rang up the sale. The charge went through without a blip. I signed the slip and tucked my copy of the receipt in my jeans pocket, wondering if it was an expense I could write off. I allowed her to swaddle the coat in tissue paper before she placed it into a shopping bag. I thanked her and left, making a quick right-hand turn into the wig shop next door, where I selected a head of shoulder-length blonde hair for $29.95. I pulled it on, slicking my hair under the edges of the wig and out of sight. I stared at myself in the mirror, bemused by the woman looking back at me. The sales clerk was male and clearly had opinions about what was suitable for someone who looked as clueless as I did.
Maybe something closer to your natural shade, he said.
I like this. It's perfect. While it was already hot and scratchy, I was smitten with the image of myself as a blonde.
I'm not a fan of synthetics. If you don't mind my saying so, I'd recommend real hair. We have hand or machine-tied cranial prostheses with non-slip cap construction.
This is for a costume party. It's a joke. He was wise enough to keep additional remarks to himself, but his disappointment was palpable. The transaction took longer than I thought was absolutely necessary, but it gave me a chance to pull out the coat and shrug myself into it. I put my shoulder bag in the twine-handled shopping bag, knowing that from a distance, my shoulder bag was as much a visual cue to my identity as my clothing.
Nice coat, he said as he handed me my change.
Lord and Taylor.
I can tell.
The short walk back to the pawn shop gave me the opportunity to scour the area for surveillance measures. While I didn't see anything that seemed out of place, that was no guarantee Len hadn't made the relevant arrangements. At the same time, I didn't believe he had an unlimited number of pals willing to volunteer their services, regardless of the story he told. When I re-entered the pawn shop, June was busy with a customer but looked up. She wasn't fooled by my disguise, but it wasn't meant to deceive her. As soon as she was free, she gestured me over. The two guys working with her must have been aware what we were up to, because neither paid much attention when she ushered me into the rear. Pinky was holed up in a combination broom closet and bathroom, where a toilet and small sink shared space with mops, a bucket on wheels, and storage shelves filled top to bottom with recently hawked power tools and small home appliances. The air smelled like motor oil and an air freshener that didn't even come close to freshening the air. A black and white television monitor on one side of the vanity displayed a view of the shop out front. As soon as Pinky realized it was me, he flashed me a big, goofy grin, probably thinking June had talked me into helping him where he had failed. He took my hand in his and patted it. "Thank you." I wanted to point out I hadn't done anything yet, but I had another matter on my mind. "What are you doing here? I thought you'd set up a meeting with some guy to hand over the photographs. Wasn't that the plan?"
"Oh, that's just it. I've been trying to get in touch with the fellow, but his office doesn't know where he is. June let me go out to the counter twice to use the phone, but then she put her foot down. She's worried Lynn'll come in or one of his guys will spot me through the window. Anyways, the guy's receptionist has been nice about it and says if I tell her where I am, she'll send someone to pick me up as soon as he arrives." I said, "Really? Well, that's accommodating. What's she think is going on?" "Beats me. I didn't tell her nothing."
He tapped his head to show he was using his brains. "So now what do we do?"
"Transform you into a girl and get you out of here."
I turned to June. "I need you to call a taxi. Tell the dispatcher the pickup's a blonde woman in a camel hair coat who'll be on Hidalgo at the side entrance to the Butler Hotel."
"How soon?"
10 minutes. "And tell the cabbie to wait in case it takes longer than we think."
"I'll leave you two alone," she said as she moved away.
I made Pinky perch on the toilet lid while I took the wig from my head and secured it to his. He didn't look that bad as a blonde, though his wide shoulders and swarthy complexion gave him the look of a middle-aged Miami transvestite. Once he slipped into the camel hair coat, most of his tattoos disappeared. I thought he'd passed muster from afar. With luck, he'd be able to walk the half block, slip into the hotel's front entrance, and out the side door. I wrote Rosie's address on the back of the receipt from the wig shop and gave him $30 in cash. "I'll call and tell her you're coming. She'll keep you out of sight until I get home. It won't be until after dark, so don't get antsy on me. Any questions?"
"Can you call Dodie and tell her I'm okay? I know she's worried about me."
"That can wait. I talked to her a while ago and she's fine. She'll feel better if she hears my voice.
Listen to me. Are you listening? Do not call her. She thinks the house is bugged, and she may well be right. A phone conversation would be picked up."
"I wouldn't say where I was."
"What if your home line has a trap on it?"
"Wouldn't matter. I'd be quick. I could use a special code to let her know I'm safe."
"How can you concoct a code without talking to her first?"
"I could ask about the parrot, which she knows we don't have. I could say, 'Is the parrot fine?' and like that."
"Pinky, please don't make life any more complicated than it is. This is all beside the point. Dodie told me about the mugshots of her. Where'd you put the second set of photographs?"
He parted the front of his shirt slightly, and I could see a portion of the manila envelope.
"I'm not letting go of this until I hand it over."
"Good plan." Shyly, he patted the sides of the blonde wig
How do I look?
Adorable, I said. Here's the drill. I'm going to stroll out the front door and go around the corner to the parking lot where I'll pick up my car. You wait 5 or 6 minutes and then leave and head in the opposite direction. You know where the butler is?
Sure, it's up on the corner.
Perfect. You take the cab to Rosie's and stay put. Her husband will bring you to my place after dark. Are we clear?
I guess.
All right. Once I leave, you wait.
I got it already. 5 minutes and I hoof it up to the butler.
Don't hoof it. Stroll. See you later. June let me borrow the phone and I called Rosie's. William answered, and when I explained what we were doing, he said he'd be happy to help. I told him to stick Pinky in a booth with his back to the door. I'd be grateful if Rosie agreed to feed him supper, though I did caution him with regard to alcohol, as I wasn't sure about Pinky's tolerance. As soon as it was fully dark, William was to walk Pinky to Henry's house, using the alleyway that runs along his rear property line. I figured a nice-looking elderly couple out and about at that hour wouldn't attract much notice. I retrieved my car and headed for home. My route was straightforward, though I did stop briefly at the supermarket to pick up milk and toilet paper. I hoped to give any surveillance types the impression that I was dull-witted and unsuspecting. I still hadn't identified a tail, but it was a safe bet one was there. When I finally pulled into Henry's driveway, I left the Mustang parked in front of the garage doors. I let myself into the studio and turned on the lights. I closed the lower bank of shutters in the living room and went up the spiral stairs to the bedroom, where I turned on additional lights. When I came downstairs again, I spent a few minutes crawling along the baseboards again, looking for a listening device. The studio was still clean, as far as I could tell. I turned on the television set, sound slightly higher than I liked it in case anyone was there to overhear. I turned off the outside lights as though I were in for the night, and then eased out the door again and crossed the patio to Henry's house. The lights in the front rooms were on timers, but the kitchen wasn't part of the circuit. I left the room in darkness, using my penlight to do my usual walkabout, making sure all was well. Then I used his phone to place a call to him in Michigan. While it didn't appear Len had bugged my studio, I thought Henry's phone was clean. I asked about Nell, and he filled me in on her condition, which was much improved. After that, I brought him up to date on my falling out with Marvin, the recording device on my office phone, and the problem I had with Pinky on my hands. I didn't need to justify my request to park him at Henry's for the night. I swore I'd call him again in the morning and fill him in on anything that transpired from that point on. Darkness had settled over the neighborhood by then. I sat on Henry's back step to wait. 10 minutes later, I heard a rustling in the shrubbery along the alleyway. If you pushed the chicken wire fence until it bowed, it was possible to slip through the gap. I got up and crossed to the side of the garage. When Pinky pushed through, it was a simple matter to usher him into Henry's kitchen. I had to pray William wouldn't go back to Rosie's and blab the whole scheme to anyone who came in looking for a drink. I locked the door behind us and led Pinky into the inner sanctum of Henry's hallway. I closed the doors leading to the bedrooms, the living room, and the kitchen, and finally turned to him. He looked like he was having the time of his life, which I found irritating. He was surveying the hallway, probably hoping there was something to steal.
This is your place? I remembered it different.
It belongs to a friend of mine who's out of town. You can stay here tonight, but you have to promise you won't go into any of the other rooms. There are timers on the lights, so they'll be going off and on. People in the neighborhood know Henry's gone, so if you're moving around, someone might notice and call the cops, thinking there's been a break-in.
Hey, right. Cops are the last thing we need.
That's correct. Can you behave yourself?
Oh, sure, but I gotta tell you, I'm so hungry I could eat my own arm. I've been in the pawn shop all day, and the only thing June had handy was a box of milk duds that made my teeth hurt.
Rosie was supposed to give you supper.
She did, but you should have seen it. I didn't even know what it was. Little gristle bits and sauce. I pretended to eat and enjoy myself, but I have a delicate stomach, and it was all I could do to keep from hurling chunks.
Your friend have anything I could eat?
Hold on, and I'll check. I went through Henry's kitchen cabinets in search of food. I knew all the perishables were gone because he'd given them to me. I found a box of Cheerios, but no milk. He did have a bottle of cold Coke and a small can of V8. He also had a can of cashews, a packet of graham crackers, and some peanut butter. I considered the Jack Daniels, which Pinky could probably use, but decided not to tempt fate. I took out a tray and placed the items on it, along with a paper napkin and some flatware. I wouldn't have minded such a feast myself, but opted against keeping Pinky company. I took the tray into the inner hall and set it down for him. He popped open the Coke and chugged about half. While he was slapping peanut butter between graham crackers, I went into the bathroom and closed the blinds. "Coming out," I said. "You can use the bathroom if you leave the light off. Do you swear?" Mouth full, Pinky nodded and held two fingers to his temple as though taking a Boy Scout oath. I've done the same thing myself and know how little it means. He swallowed and then used his finger to clear the peanut butter from his teeth. "Can I trouble you for a blanket and pillow?" "Fine." The man was exasperating. But I'd signed on of my own free will and didn't feel I had a right to complain. I opened the door to the hall closet where Henry keeps his linens. I pulled out a pillow, a wool blanket, and a big puffy comforter. You can put down a couple of big bath towels if the floor gets too hard.
"Thanks. This'll do nice."
I pointed at him sternly. "Behave."
"I'm not doing anything."
I returned to my studio. I would have loved getting into my robe and slippers, but my day wasn't over yet. Closer to bedtime, I'd pay Pinky another visit to make sure all was well. He struck me as a man with a limited imagination, which meant that entertaining himself might prove strenuous. For dinner, I made myself a hot, hard-boiled egg sandwich with mayo and put it on a paper plate. Then I poured myself a glass of cake bread Chardonnay and picked up the Santa Teresa dispatch, still folded for delivery. I settled on the couch, opened the paper, and munched my sandwich while I read the news. It was the first chance I'd had to relax since I'd left home that morning. The obituaries were unremarkable, and world news was standard. War in six different places on the planet, a train wreck, a mine collapse, and an infant born to a woman who was 62 years old. The Dow was down, the Nasdaq up, or it might have been the other way around. The only item of note, and this made me sit up straight, was a squib on page 6 in a section that listed brief reports of local crime. This was the daily summary of chicaneries too minor to warrant full-on reporting. Most were simple. A car had been jacked up and the tires removed. A wallet had been snatched from a woman on Lower State Street. What caught my eye was a wee paragraph that indicated that a homeowner, returning after a weekend away, discovered someone had broken into her house and removed a fire safe previously bolted to the closet floor. Abigail Upshaw, age 26, estimated her losses, which included jewelry, cash, silverware, and assorted items of sentimental value, at approximately $3,000. Ah, Abby Upshaw was Len Pretty's girlfriend, and I thought it safe to assume Pinky was the one who'd burgled the place. According to what he'd told me, he'd gone in search of the damning photographs of Dodie, which he must have thought Len was hiding at his place. That jaunt was fruitless, so Pinky had turned his attention to the girlfriend. I still had no idea who was featured in the second set of photographs, or what made them so priceless as barter. But maybe I'd find out in due course.
Almost subliminally, I heard the squeaking of my front gate, and I looked up from the paper. The arrow on my inner sensor whipped into the red zone. I set the paper aside and went to the front door, where I flipped on the porch light and looked out through the porthole. Marvin Stryker appeared on my doorstep, looking impish and ill at ease. I opened the door. What are you doing here?
I need to talk to you.
How'd you know where I lived?
I asked Diana Alvarez. She knows everything. You might keep that in mind in case something comes up. May I come in?
Why not? I said. I stepped aside, allowing him to enter.
Mind if I sit down?
I gestured at the seating in my wee living room. His choices were the sofa bed or one of my two royal blue director's chairs. He chose one chair, and I sat down in the other, which caused both our canvas seats to make embarrassing noises. I wasn't feeling cranky with the man, but I didn't think I should act like we were still the same good buddies we'd been before he'd tried to fire my ass.
What can I do for you?
I owe you an apology.
Really?
He reached into his inner suit coat pocket and pulled out a windowed envelope with a yellow strip across the bottom. The return address in the upper left-hand corner of the envelope was the Wells Fargo Bank in San Luis Obispo, complete with a tiny stagecoach. I took the envelope and read the name of the recipient, Audrey Vance. The yellow strip indicated a change of address from the little house in San Luis to Marvin's in Santa Teresa. Vivian Hewitt had apparently filled out a form at the post office, forwarding Audrey's mail to him, as I'd asked her to do. He'd already torn open the envelope. I said, "May I look?"
"That's why I brought it. Help yourself."
The statement was subdivided into numerous blocks of information, some in bold print, including phone numbers available for those who wanted to conduct a conversation in English, Spanish, or Chinese. Other nationalities were screwed. There were also columns giving dollar figures for total assets, total liabilities, available credit, interest, dividends, and other income. All of Audrey's transactions had been itemized, deposits going back to the first of the year. To date, she had $4,944.44 in her account. No withdrawals. I was impressed by how quickly the minimal interest on $4 million added up.
"I don't think she got that much money managing wholesale accounts," he remarked.
"Probably not."
"I wondered if you'd consider taking up your investigation where you left off."
"Well, now, Marvin, that presents a problem, and I'll tell you what it is. Your good friend and confidant, Len Pretty, threatened to hurt me very badly if I pursued the case." A flicker of a smile played across his mouth, as though he was waiting for the punchline to a joke.
"What do you mean?
He threatened you?"
"He said he'd kill me. But not literally. He didn't actually say the words."
"He did." Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a wash of light slide across the windows looking out on the street. I closed the lower set of shutters, which were hinged and had a little stick in the middle that adjusted the slats at an up slant, a down slant, or completely closed. The bottom bank was fully closed, but I'd left the uppers open. A car had come to a stop outside, double parked by my reckoning, since I could hear the engine idle. While Marvin and I explored the subtleties of language, I was wondering if a brick was going to come flying through the glass, perhaps a Molotov cocktail refuting Marvin's point about my misunderstanding Len's comment, which Marvin swore was made in jest. I assured him of the seriousness of Len's intent and moved on to my definition of common sense, which was to cease and desist behavior that might result in bodily harm. He derided my being so easily intimidated, whereas I felt the promise of death was sufficient to dash any residual bravery on my part. It was when I caught the tiny squeak of my gate that I excused myself, saying, "Would you excuse me?"
"No problem." I left him sitting in my living room while I grabbed Henry's key and headed out the door and across the patio to his place. The timer in his living room caused the lights to wink off, and 2 seconds later, his bedroom light winked on. This was intended to persuade folks that he was in residence and on his way to bed. I let myself into the darkened kitchen and crossed the room in 3 long strides. I opened the door to the hall. Pinky? His picnic tray was pushed to one side, and I noticed he'd eaten everything. He hadn't yet made up his homely palate on the floor. Instead, he'd pulled the telephone from the kitchen into the hall, stretching the spiral cord to its full extension. This permitted him to close the hall door and thus keep himself judiciously confined to the inner recesses of Henry's house. The bathroom door was shut. I knocked, not wanting to surprise him if he was settled on the toilet with his trousers down around his ankles. I leaned my head against the door. Pinky, are you in there? I opened the door to an empty bathroom. I turned and took 2 steps, reaching for the knob on the door between the hall and the darkened living room. This allowed me a clear view through the front windows where a taxicab was pulling away, a brightly lighted yellow blur against the dark outside as it moved out of my view. The passenger silhouetted in the rear seat looked very much like Pinky to me. Chapter 28. I backed the Mustang out of the driveway, shifted from reverse into drive, and peeled out with a screech of tires that sounded like I'd just run over a cat. Marvin stood on the street and watched me with disbelief. I'd hustled him out of my studio with only the briefest of excuses. Poor, sweet man. He'd come, hat in hand, humbling himself in order to persuade me to go back on the job. But I was anxious about Pinky's disappearance, and I couldn't afford to stop and renegotiate. By my calculation, Pinky had a 5-minute head start on me, and I'd have been willing to bet he was heading for home. Dodie couldn't have called him, because she didn't know where he was. If the two had been in contact, he'd have had to call her. Given the total population of the Earth at that time, there were other possibilities. He might have contacted any one of the millions of other human beings who were stretched around the globe. But since he'd been so insistent on touching base with her, my supposition made sense. Why he'd called a cab and dashed off without telling me, I hoped to find out when I caught up with him. Whatever his motivation, he must have believed I wouldn't buy into it, and therefore he hadn't wanted to risk informing me. My apartment near the beach was approximately 12 blocks from Pinky's duplex on Paseo, 1.5 miles at most. The speed limit on most residential streets was 35 miles an hour. I didn't want to think about stop signs and red lights and other automotive impediments that would slow my progress. I kept a heavy foot on the gas pedal, checking cross streets for approaching vehicles before I sailed through each intersection. I didn't run any red lights, but I came close. I was acutely tuned to the risk of black and whites in the area, being not that far away from the police department. I headed north on Chapel, which at that hour didn't have much traffic, so I was making good time. I didn't see the problem until I was right up on it, preparing to turn left on Paseo. A barrier had been erected. A row of orange cones was neatly set out in front of 6 sections of portable fence, replete with a sign that said, "Road closed to through traffic." I debated an act of civil disobedience. Instead, I continued up Chapel, thinking to turn left at the next cross street, which was also blocked. This felt like a cruel hoax, but was more likely part of a public works rehabilitation project relegated to off hours instead of a plot cooked up specifically to inconvenience me. At the next block up, the street was open but marked one way, the arrow urging me most emphatically to the right when I wanted to turn left. I said, "To hell with it," and turned left anyway, driving the wrong way down a one-way street. At the back of my mind, I was aware that I wasn't exactly stone-cold sober. Less than an hour before, I'd had a glass of wine, 6 ounces by my guess, but possibly 8, with my sandwich. At my height and body weight, I was flirting with the legal limit for blood alcohol content. I was probably under the .08 threshold, but if a cop stopped me for a moving violation, I might well be required to go through a whole song and dance routine, even if I wasn't compelled to submit breath or body fluids. A traffic ticket would take more time than I could spare. I accelerated as far as Dave Levine Street, turned left, drove 2 blocks, and then turned left again on Paseo. There was a sleek, new yellow Cadillac parked near the corner with a bumper sticker that read, "I own this glorious car thanks to glorious womanhood." On the driver's side door, there was a golden figure of a woman with her arms upraised, surrounded by a shower of shooting stars. I found a convenient parking space along an unoccupied length of red-painted curb. I did a masterly job of parallel parking, obscuring the fire hydrant. I shut down the engine, and as I got out of the car, I hesitated. I went through a quick debate about taking my H&K. Pinky's departure had generated a sense of urgency, but perhaps only in my fevered imagination. There was no reason to think a gun battle would ensue, so I left mine and the Mustang under the driver's seat. I opened the trunk and shrugged into the windbreaker I keep on hand, and then left my unwieldy shoulder bag locked inside. I tucked my keys into my jeans pocket and crossed the street to the duplex. I could see lights on upstairs in the McWhirter's apartment on the right. The Ford's living room also showed lights on the ground floor to the left. The drapes were partially drawn, but I spotted Pinky sitting in an easy chair. Dodie sat on the couch to his right, largely blocked by the window hangings. The lights of the television flickered dully across their faces. If seeing Dodie was so important, I couldn't understand why he looked so sulky. With his high cheekbones and swarthy complexion, his face appeared to be carved out of wood. I rang the bell, and moments later he opened the door. "Why'd you run off without telling me?" "I was in a hurry," he said. "Well, clearly. Mind if I come in?" "Might as well." He stepped away from the door. The foyer was about the size of a bath towel, with the living room opening directly to the right. There was a fire in the fireplace, but the logs were fake, and the flames appeared from an evenly spaced row of holes in the gas pipe under the grate. The logs were fabricated from a product that mimicked both the outer bark and the raw look of freshly hewn oak, but there was none of the pop and crackle of a live fire, and no homely smell of wood smoke. Hard to believe a fire like that had much to offer in the way of warmth. Not that either Pinky or Dodie cared. His attention was fixed on the fellow with a gun pressed against the back of Dodie's head. It looked like the guy had dragged in a chair from the dining room and sat behind the sofa using the back of it to steady his hand. The gun was a semi-automatic, but I didn't have a clue about the manufacturer. For me, guns and cars fall into the same general category, some identifiable on sight, but many only meaningful by reason of their capacity to maim and kill. What I noticed about this gun was the large frame and a satin chrome finish on the barrel, which also featured a curlicue flourish of leaves engraved along the length. The caliber didn't matter much, because with the front sight pressed hard up against Dodie's skull, she couldn't have survived the trigger pull in any event. She rolled an eye in my direction without moving her head. She was convinced the place was bugged, and she was probably holding out hope the conversation was being monitored with the possibility of help on the way. I suspected if there was a bug at all, it was connected to a voice-activated tape recorder that would be left unattended until the tape ran out. I shifted my gaze and focused on the gunman. He was in his mid-40s, with a thatch of dark blonde hair that stuck up in places. He had 2 days' worth of whiskers and a nose that angled slightly to the right.
His lips were open as though breathing through his mouth was the preferred method for taking in air. Running shoes, jeans, synthetic shirt fabric looking formless and cheap. I might have considered him handsome if he hadn't looked so dumb. Smart guys you can reason with. This mope was dangerous. His eyes flicked from Pinky to me. Who's this?
Friend of mine.
I'm Kinsey. Nice meeting you. Sorry to barge in, I said.
This is Cappy Dante, Pinky said, to complete the formalities.
I remembered Cappy's name from my conversation with Diana Alvarez and Melissa Mendenhall. His brother was the local loan shark who might or might not have played a part in Melissa's boyfriend's death. According to her account, Cappy had roughed up a friend of hers, and there was hell to pay when her friend complained to the Vegas police.
Nice.
When I called home earlier, he was already here, holding her at gunpoint. That's why I called the cab and tore out of there without telling you, Cappy said. Get her over here so I can watch you pat her down.
I left my gun in the car, I said.
Says you, he gestured impatiently. Pinky and I moved into range, and the goon kept a close watch while I turned sideways and lifted my arms, allowing Pinky to run his hands down my sides and along the legs of my jeans.
She's not armed, he said.
I told you so, I said.
Shut your smart-ass mouth and keep your hands up where I can see them, Cappy said.
I complied, not wanting to annoy the man more than I already had. Pinky returned to the easy chair and took a seat while I stood with my palms turned up as though checking for rain.
Mind if I ask what's going on?
Cappy said. I came to pick up a set of photographs. He shifted his attention to Pinky.
You want to get on with it?
Pinky unbuttoned the front of his shirt, extracted the manila envelope, and held it out to him.
These are Lynn's, you know. He's not going to appreciate any interference from you. Pass them over to your friend. We'll let her do the honors as long as she's here.
I took the envelope. Cappy gestured with the gun, motioning me to the fireplace. I crossed the room. I'm supposed to burn these?
Very good, he said. It'll go faster if I take them out and do them one by one, I said.
Having been threatened with death over the self-same photographs, I was curious to see what all the fuss was about. Cappy thought for a moment, perhaps wondering if there was trickery afoot. I was a good 15 feet away from him, and he must have realized my options were limited. There were no fireplace tools and nothing that might double as a weapon.
Suit yourself, he said.
I tore open the flap and removed the photographs, taking care not to display overt curiosity. The prints were 8x10s, in glossy black and white. The first showed Len Pretty and Cappy sitting in a parked car. It was a night scene, and the picture was taken with a zoom lens from across the street. The light wasn't fabulous, but the close-up left no doubt who it was. I held the print to the fire, and the corner began to curl. Dodie's gaze was averted, and Pinky's expression was bleak. I tilted the picture to allow the flames to climb along the edge. When it was fully engulfed, I dropped it on top of the fake logs where it continued to burn. I took the next print and subjected it to the same treatment. Len and Cappy were photographed from roughly the same angle at different locations, but the gist was the same. I focused on the job, guiding the flames as the fire chewed and digested the images. Judging from Cappy's selection of tasteless shirts, he and Len met on 6 occasions. While I worked my way through, I thought back to Cheney Phillips's comment about my putting a confidential informant at risk. Dodie told me Len was using the mugshots of her to ensure that Pinky continued to funnel street rumors in his direction. If this second set of photographs was valuable, it probably meant Len was using them to keep Cappy in line as well. Len himself had nothing to fear from the images. The name of a CI is a closely guarded matter.
and if his relationship with Cappy came to light, he could write it off as police business, which it probably was. On the other hand, I had to assume that if Dante found out his brother was having conversations with a vice detective, Cappy would be dead.